My name is Ian O'Neill, and this is How They Did It, a podcast where we learn filmmaking from those who've gone before us. Welcome, everyone, to How They Did It, a podcast for indie filmmakers, especially those just starting out looking to make their very first film, although anyone at any level can listen and learn. Carlo Asagian has been an active member of the filmmaking community for more than 25 years. He's a writer, actor, producer, and director who's made several short films, including his latest, Love Thongs. He loves to talk filmmaking, so without further ado, here's the interview. My guest today is Carlo Asagian. Carlo, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me. Hey, and you're doing a great job, by the way. I've heard a few of these.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You've been around for a long time. You've been acting for quite a while too, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And it's something that I've, ever since I was in elementary school, this is a while back. I'm from Montreal originally. I'm born in Montreal. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that when I was in elementary school in grade four, I had this teacher who told me we had this activity day where we had drama as one of the activities. And I thought I'd throw this right in there because I thought about it recently. Someone approached me from Guy Drummond Elementary School on Facebook, and it made me think of that time. And I realized it was grade four when this teacher, Barbara King, said to me that I had potential in that drama activity. And I thought, wow, I ran home excited. I got upstairs up to the third or fifth floor that we lived in that little apartment because my parents are immigrants and everything. And I was like, so excited about this thing that I have. And I looked up potential in the dictionary and realized what it meant. And I thought, wow, really? I can do this? So that propelled me to look into that because I used to dream about being on TV while watching The Partridge Family. Do you remember that show?
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to be a member of that family. As dysfunctional as they were, I thought they were the perfect family. I wanted to be Susan Day's younger brother.
Well, see, you had a different feeling about Susan Day than I did. I didn't want to be her younger brother, let me tell you. Not the Brady Bunch? Everybody thinks they want to be a part of the Brady Bunch.
I had a crush on Susan Day. I just couldn't stay away, so I wanted to be part of that.
I'm with you there, brother. I'm with you there. Listen, since you've been in the business for so long, let's talk about some things that first-time filmmakers are struggling with. And one of those things is when they conceptualize their films. What kind of advice can you give them? What kind of experience have you had with conceptualizing?
Conceptualizing, and that's interesting that you're saying it that way because, for example, Driver's Test, which I did about 12 years ago. It's a story about an old man who gets who fails his driver's test at 84 years old and has to be retested by the same driving instructor who failed him the first time. Okay. A month later, and it would be like a 25-year-old female, and he's like an 85-year-old male thinking, oh, I've driven for 50 years, how dare. Anyway, so my concept, the way I conceptualized this was I was looking for a project to do. I was restless to do a project, and I heard that my father was 84 years old, and he had just failed his driver's test that he's obligated to take.
Yeah.
So I couldn't believe it, and I woke up one morning thinking, wait a minute, there's a funny story there. I woke up with the idea that an old man fails, goes and gets tested again, passes, and he would decide to stop driving on his own volition. So that concept just happened like that. And I was on a one piece of paper. I wrote it down. So my advice would be write down as soon as you've got the genesis of the idea. Write it down and start letting it percolate because it'll come together as you think about it. And then you make notes on it and you expand it and then you see the beats where it's going to be funny and you got the open and you got the delivery. Now, when you're making shorts, it's a challenge because this was a short. It's a challenge because a lot of time as a writer and a filmmaker, you want to, as a film producer, you want to see it as a movie, like a 90-minute.
Right.
And while you can use the template a professional template of making movies for a short. For a short, you can see it as two things, in my mind. You see it as a movie where it's got a beginning, middle, end, or you see it as a sketch, a comedic sketch, where it's got the beginning, middle beats, and the end.
Yeah.
So for Driver's Test, it had to be that. Yeah. It had to be that quick punch and the end, bing, bang. And it was like, da-da-da-da-da-da. It was done.
Well, yeah. You know what? It sounds like when you're talking about conceptualizing, not to just run with it so quickly. Like you have to let it, you have to let it percolate for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's, because it's got to get into your head. You've got to find that those other things that go into the story, rather than here's a great idea. I'm going to make this film on a great idea. You've got to expand that idea. You got to take your time.
Yes, and then when you're doing that, which is amazing that you're mentioning that, Ian, because this is a point I wanted to bring across: is you end up having this vision. And when you have this vision and you start talking to it with certain people, people will respond to it. They see the passion, the conviction, the vision that you have, and they gravitate towards it. I was amazed at how many people wanted to jump on board and help and make this film. And they were able to relate to it. And next thing I know, I had old friends, older gentlemen, who wanted to be part of this. And lo and behold, Michael Sennelnikoff, who was a television star at the time, or he just, been in 22 episodes of Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World series as Professor Summerlee. He jumped on board, took a train from Montreal, came to Guelph, Ontario, and had a bit part in the film, but he was encouraging me. And that was amazing. I had Dean Hagopian, also a radio celebrity and actor in Montreal. He came over as well, drove himself to Guelph. And it worked out really well having these gentlemen in the film. And when you see that happen, and I asked the city of Guelph permission to shoot in and around the area, the person who was looking after the film issues in Guelph or permits, she wanted to come on set because the buzz, she could feel it.
Wow.
And thought it'd be hilarious. And I said, yeah, sure. So I ordered catering to make sure there was enough to go around for the actors and crew and everything.
Absolutely.
Because I wanted this to be a happy experience.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that's really, really important. It's about the experience that you have making the film, so that it resonates on screen as well. There's a connection I'll make later on if we have to. But the thing was that I arranged for the local journalists to come on set when the catering would arrive.
Wow!
I had used two cameras so we can get through action reaction shots at particular angles, so we can speed up the necessary footage we needed. We don't have to spend all day moving cameras around,
right?
And adjusting for lighting because it was outside. So lo and behold, we were done by noon. It was 11 o'clock. And Michael Sennelnikoff was sitting down with the journalists and they were all enjoying a nice meal and writing. And we got two full page write-ups in the local papers from that experience. And it was all the vision. It was all conceptualizing it, sharing the ideas with others, and people jumping on board wanting to help. And I was in a coffee shop talking to an owner about my idea. And he said, well, how can I help? I want to encourage local filmmakers. And he gave us cases of water to give out.
Wow.
And coffee machines. We got those for free, the coffee, the canisters.
Really?
Yeah. So we had a craft service table. I paid for food, like knickknacks, little snacks and things as well. But there was a lot of like coffee and water donated.
Wow.
And it was people wanting to help. They see the vision. They see the passion. And they want to jump on board. They want to be a part of it. So it helps to take your concept and let it percolate and then share it with others because they'll see and they'll want to jump on board.
Right. So when you're doing that conceptualizing, though, because at some point when it's percolating, you got to write this thing.
You got to write this thing.
Yeah.
That's right.
So what can you tell us about the writing process?
Okay, the writing. I've done a lot of writing in the last 12 years, actually, that you're talking about the writing is from Driver's Test to Love Thongs, which is the current film that I've just wrapped up.
By the way, love the name of that movie.
Love Thongs.
Oh.
It started off 12 years ago with the boring title of Married. And then I switched it to Trail of Thongs because of what happens in the content. But then it came to Love Thongs. And I thought, you know what? That's catchy.
Oh, I love
That's catchy. I could see a song written about it if it's not already. But anyway.
Brilliant.
So the writing process for me was taking the concept and then breaking it down to its beats of how it's going to play out and where the locations would be, and then how can I make this happen. And I wanted it to happen so quickly because my father was going to take his test in 30 days.
Right.
So I wanted it to be done and edited and delivered. Back in the days, it was CDs or DVDs in his hand so he could see it. Right. And he could get the idea in his head that he can actually go out on his own volition. He doesn't have to, you know, keep driving.
Yeah.
And what happened was I approached the union.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we were talking about the writing, so I'll stick with that idea. The writing, as I wrote, I thought it'd be fun to have the son driving the dad to the driving test center.
Oh,
and
boy.
So I started off the story, and it would be a typical situation. And then I threw in the dad would be ethnic, and he would have his own little perceptions, that cultural perceptions. He'll look at the girl and say, "She gave me the evil eye. Oh, no, she cursed me. It's the same one. I'm going to fail again." So he had all his illusions that he's going to be failing and the fears. And I played on that for humor. And he threw in something brilliant in the conversation I had with him, because I was an actor that I wanted to have. And he said something like, "Oh, yeah, and my father used to say, bullshit." So I said, "Okay, let's use that." So we kept it going with like three times as a gag.
Bullshit.
So at the end, it's a cute little ending, and you hear his voice going, bullshit. So it became part of the writing. And you get ideas from others and yourself, and I went for it, and I kept on tightening it to make sure that it was funny.
Yeah,
it had to.
That's important. That's really important, to tighten it. I think a lot of new filmmakers, when they're writing their scripts, they fall in love with their own words.
Oh yeah,
and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and a 5 minute becomes a 10 minute, and you keep it tight, guys. Listen to what Carlo is saying. Keep it tight,
and it features as well. Features is unbelievable, because that's one thing that, lucky for me as an actor, I've run across many scripts, Hollywood scripts, Canadian scripts, a lot of different types of screenplays that I've read. And when I wrote, I went off and bought a different book each time I was writing a script, just to be inspired on the subject. And one of my favorites is David Troche's Bible, the Bible, the screenwriter's Bible.
The screenwriter's Bible.
Just because it gives tips on every aspect.
You know what, though? I have a problem with a book that calls itself a Bible, because
everybody
says you have to do it this way. I've had a couple of people, I love sharing my work, and because you can learn something from everybody. But I remember putting it up on a site and having a bunch of people have at it, and they all quoted the Bible, and you have to. I remember using ellipses, and because there was a space between each one, or there wasn't a space between each period, they complained about it, and I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding. Who cares? Yeah.
Okay, that's right. That's one of the things that really I want to take away from this, is that when I look at what I want to share is, when I look at the screenplays and the writings of other people, I see what I like, and I see how the story reads visually.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen shortcuts where people write from top to bottom, and it really picks up the pace, and it's the economy of words. It's less than four lines, like general kind of rules in the narrative and dialogue. Concise, succinct. You got to make sure that it's not the same voice for every character.
Yep.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
So, and that's homework involved. And for me, if you asked me what my writing style is like, or how I go about it, I mean, I've written a lot over the last 12 years between the two films. I've written features and shorts. And for me, I would sit in front of the computer, the typewriter. I mean,
you're showing your age now.
Yeah, I'm aging myself. No, but the laptop, and I would look at the blank page, and I would love to say, I want to quote Stephen King and say, the blank page is my inspiration, right? But my motivation is the blank page. No, it's not. I would sit there, once I've written interior, exterior, and I start writing, then the flow happens. It's great. But there's so many moments where I would run out and get a coffee and come back,
or absolutely.
Well, I've had stories where the recent one, I was getting excited about it. So I'd go out with a friend and meet for coffee, tell him this idea, this vision. And he's not in the field. So he would say, yeah, yeah, go for it. Do that. Do that. Sounds great. Now, so when are you going to write this? And he goes, oh, yeah, I was writing it. I'm going to go home and finish it. So it's one of those things,
distractions,
right?
We all get them.
And when you discipline, when you really narrow it down and get down to the work, you get so excited about what you're doing. It's you want to jump out of your seat anyway, because you've got a sense of accomplishment. You've just written a great scene, and it's so fulfilling. And if you could stop yourself and say, okay, tomorrow is going to be the next one, and then you can actually schedule a time and do it, build it as a puzzle, and you put the pieces together, and you end up having a story, and it works. Yeah. And you'd be surprised how quick it'll feel when you're on a roll and you do that. I think building a momentum is really, really key. Whatever way a momentum works for you, right, that would be the way to do it. I mean, that's to me, it was.
Listen, you mentioned books, right? Do you have any other books on writing that you might want to mention?
Actually, the typical ones, you know, the Sid Fields and the other ones.
Sid Field is my favorite. I love Nolan? Screenwriting and
I forgot that.
The writer's journey,
right? With mythology,
yeah,
and yeah, I've liked that.
That's a great book.
The idea of that, and I mean, when we take a story and we decipher it so much, I worry about us as writers moving away from what the story is that we want to write,
right,
into figuring out the math of it,
right,
and what's going to happen.
Yeah,
next.
Don't get caught up so much in it, right? Yeah,
sometimes the story leads us.
Yeah, sometimes that's true.
Questions we have to figure out in the story.
Yeah, yeah.
That we write.
Listen, you. So of course you've written these great movies, but you got to produce them.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that the tough part?
Yeah, that's the tough part, because I've been in the past 12 years I've been working as an actor. I mean, I was longer than that, but I was concentrating on acting, and my kids were growing up as well, and so we had all kinds of activities and things going on that would take up a lot of time and energy, and I would come back to, I've got this project I want to do, and I still feel like I've got some great little stories that are great films, like feature length films, that I wasn't ready yet for. Like I'm financially not deep enough pockets, that's a big one.
Yeah,
and very other for various other reasons, but the short. Well, you asked me I'm just trying to make sure I answer your question about
producing.
Right. I've got to produce them. So here it was 12 years went by since my last short, and I thought, okay, I've written all these features. It's time I produce something. I grabbed the rights to a book a few years ago that I liked the premise of, and I didn't have the patience to wait for someone else to write it as a producer, like to pay someone else.
Right.
I wanted to see about building it myself.
Right.
I asked around and I talked about it, and I started writing it based on the book. And I was trying to be so loyal to the book that I felt like I wasn't doing the story as a film any justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I started making it as a film and as a comedic film. So suddenly it became a different story.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, wait a minute. I'm going to take this combination of book and my ideas that are making it a different story and put it back on the shelf and grab something that I can produce right away,
right,
because it's been itching in me to produce another project. Mm-hmm. It's like I tried to make this analogy, but it's not really the case. But it's like being a painter and you've got your empty canvas. And to me, making movies is like the canvas. I want to be able to make movies. It's just a very expensive medium for a canvas. Like it's not something that you can just buy at a store and put it up there and start painting on it.
Yeah.
It's an expensive ordeal. So I grabbed the short film that I thought, well, this is still viable. This is still a great story. It still works. It's couples therapy. Everyone can relate to that,
yeah,
and even more so today. And I mean, as time goes on, we're all ending up in couples. Anyway, so I grabbed the no, it's not projecting, is it? So I grabbed the that story, and I started looking at it, what I had written 12 years ago, and I realized it still works. And I could just maybe change the title, change the name.
Sure.
So I started bouncing the idea around, and I had met this couple. And they were a couple of actors, and they recently were in a comedy short film in the Canadian Film Festival last year, or this past year. So I spoke to them afterwards. Oh, no, I actually spoke to them a while afterwards, because they it suddenly hit me that they would make the couple. They would be perfect for us. And they're a real life couple, and they're comedic. So I thought this would be great.
Yeah.
And I looked at my old notes, and I thought, okay, they would be the couple. Now, who would I get as the therapist? And so I went out looking for actors in Toronto that are recognizable, that are working a lot. And I reached out to them. And while they were receptive to the idea, I learned my lesson about scheduling. You can't just say, oh, I've got a project, everyone's going to jump on board, because the timing of it, everyone has different schedules.
Yeah.
So as a producer, you realize you have to accommodate or switch things around.
Exactly.
So that's what I ended up doing. I took it from July to September. So, yeah, but I started going through the process in July with the union.
Oh, okay.
And then had to put everything on hold till September.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a month there where I wasn't sure what was going to happen, because I didn't know of the availabilities and so on. So as I inquired again, I realized, oh, things are getting tight, and I've got to get the crew, the cast, everybody together on that September 22nd to 23rd. If I don't have a date, then I don't have anything to present.
Right.
So I got the dates, and things started to fall into place. And lo and behold, the actors I wanted originally, the recent actors I wanted, weren't available. And I 3 days before the shoot, or 4 days before the shoot, I found out that one of the actors I wanted had a conflict that he couldn't get out of. And then I ended up looking back at my notes, and I looked at my sketches, and I thought of my friend, well, Michael Caruana, who I met over a decade ago as a coach. He was an acting coach, and he still is. And so I called him up and I said, hey, would you be okay with what do you think of this? And I looked at my original notes, and I actually had an original storyboard. And the way I drew the face of the therapist was exactly Michael Caruana's face.
Wow.
Like, I actually thought of him 12 years ago, and I'd forgotten that I thought of him as that role. And here, 12 years later, it fell into place like it was meant to be.
Wow.
And it was as if there was a vision back there that never left. It was in the back of my mind, and it forced me to see it. And it was all based on availability and luck that would happen. So we ended up, here's the interesting thing. We ended up Michael offering his apartment to shoot the therapist scene in. Okay. So that works out well.
Yeah. You save some production value right there.
So I went into that location area, and I walked around the neighborhood and talked to restaurants, and I was looking for a carousel or a Ferris wheel because I wanted a romantic setting.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get a hold of one that would be convenient or cost-effective. I couldn't get one at the time. And so I ended up thinking of this either absurd idea where a couple would make out in a church. So I walked along Windermere, and there are like three or four churches down the street, and I walked into one of them. And I asked, I looked them up online, actually, and I called them, and I asked about it, and I said, yeah, sure, come meet us. So I went down to meet. Now, the second time I was going back into that area, I called Dan McIver.
Oh, yeah.
And Dan. Yeah. He's I decided, we agreed that he would be the cinematographer on this. And in my mind, I wanted the cinematographer to also be the editor.
Right.
So for me, it's always good to have an editor on set.
Right.
So you know how things are going to cut. Can see what we need, what shots we need, and he would be the one to trust.
Right.
And so he was the cinematographer. He came with me to the locations that I had already quasi-negotiated.
Yeah.
I walked in and I asked for the business from a restaurant, from the church, and from Michael's location, and one other location. Oh, yeah, a building, an office building downtown. So when I brought him with me to see these locations, and he gave me the okay with them because he could see the lighting and the angles that we could shoot with, I was good with it because I felt originally that this would work, but I wanted to make sure by having the cinematographer there.
You know what? That's a great piece of advice. If you can, bring your cinematographer with you when you do your locations. Because you're right. It just proves whether that location is going to work or not.
Yeah. And that's a great takeaway, really. Yeah. You should have and for the shoots, I always want to have my editor there.
Yeah.
Because he sees the story, he knows how it's going to play out, and he knows how it's going to come together and where to edit and stuff like that. So it worked out well having the cinematographer editor there throughout the whole process.
Now, did you, during the producing of this, what about, like, it sounded like you had already landed your actors, but did you do any rehearsals? Did you do that, a table read, that kind of thing?
Oh, that's funny that you're asking me that. I actually, you know, I work as an actor, so I was going into town to go for an audition for something, and I had this script I was already developing, and when you're starting to go into the production mode, you start thinking, oh, like when you get calls for acting, you're like, oh, I don't know, I really do want to do, I want to focus on my project, but yeah, that's where the money, I got to go get paid. So I was going to this audition, and then I decided to call the actors to see if they could meet me in Toronto. And lo and behold, they lived right near that audition area.
Oh.
So they came to meet me for a coffee, and I brought the scripts with me and had them. It's a 5-minute read. So yeah. I said, let's have a look at this and tell me what you think. I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about you guys playing the couple. So they read it, and we said, okay, let's read it through together. I'll play the therapist and you guys. So we just plowed through the reading. And they both smiled, giggled at it, and thought it would work. And I said, no, really, are you sure this would work? I said, don't just tell me that to flatter me and because you want to do the thing. Just tell me honestly, do you think this would work as a comedy? And they said, yeah, I think I could see it happening. So when they said that, I started to believe that, okay, it's not just me, but I think they like the idea of it so much that they want to jump on board. Yeah. So I went away thinking, okay, that's it. I've decided we're doing this, and they're going to do it. And I'm going to call their agents and everything and work out the whole dynamics and the details. And that was the genesis of having them on it. And then it was Michael and the locations and everything else. Right. But that's how it happened. It was, let's have a coffee. And before I throw this back on the shelf, I just want to make sure that it's plausible. Because if it is, I want to make a movie this year and now. Like, let's
But next comes probably what is the biggest roadblock in filmmaking for any filmmaker, funding.
Yeah.
How did you go about, like, how do you go about funding your films?
Okay. Well, this is interesting. I could just summarize it and say I personally funded it myself. Oh. Okay. It's small. It's a short film. It's costly. It's credit cards. It's whatever it is.
Oh,
it
man.
It sets you back. It is a lot of money for, you know, it's a small production, but it's still a lot of money for a small production.
Yeah.
But it's the second time that I've used the Toronto Independent Production Program, as which is part of ACTRA's program.
Right.
ACTRA has this program where they would, for certain category films, they would permit actors to take the roles at a reduced rate.
Okay.
So they would accept these roles at a reduced rate. There's another program called the Co-op Program, and that program, I was one of the pioneering producers in Montreal of the Co-op Program back then. Mm-hmm. We had a big fuss about it. We had a big write-up about it, and everything was wonderful. It was good press about it because at the time I was the only one doing it. I thought, this is crazy. I'm an actor, but I want to make movies. And other people want to, but the tasks seem so intimidating.
Yeah.
And Ian, it is a lot of paperwork. It is a lot of organizing. It is a lot. And it's a lot that you carry on your mind while you're going through every step of the process of making a film. So being a producer and a director, you have to compartmentalize.
Yeah.
And you have to get used to that skill of okay, let myself be creative here, and also let's think business.
Yeah.
And myself, the way I operate is I want to be the kind of producer that I would want to work with. I want to be the kind of producer that I want to ask, when are you doing next film? And I want to be part of it.
Yeah.
I want to be that kind of guy. And so when I produce films, I want to make sure the environment is conducive to feeling comfortable, and the experience is amazing, that we're all having a good time. It's all about experience.
Yeah.
I want us to enjoy the process. And so when someone arrives on my film, like for Love Thongs, I asked everybody their license plate number if they were driving a car. I had this app on my phone, and I plugged in money for their plates for their cars, so their parking was taken care of.
Wow.
I didn't want them to worry or think about anything.
Wow.
And when there was somebody available, they did a coffee run and everybody had, you know, a muffin or a coffee or whatever it was.
Right.
They would have that accessible. And when the day was done, when we were time for a meal, it was a catered meal at a restaurant where we were actually shooting the restaurant scene.
Yeah.
So the actors arrived and they didn't even get a chance to do anything. I sat them down and made them eat first.
Yeah.
And then we did their scene and we only had 2 hours there. And we had 2 hours at another location in downtown Toronto, and we had 3 hours at a church. So the day was broken up in segments of 2 hours here, 3 hours there, whatever, and we had meals in between, and it worked out smoothly.
Yeah.
And to get to that point, it's really the producer's Bible. The binder. But I have a huge binder, and I don't really want to talk about that, but it was a massive binder that I was carrying around everywhere, and it had every bit of documentation, everything in there, the script, the storyboard, the details, the contracts, everything was there. If I had to refer to anything, it was in there.
Yeah. So basically, it was your Bible.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was, and it had the insurance. Every piece of documentation, like if I'm on location, I have to prove that insurance, I had it there. They've already known about it.
You know what? That's a good piece of advice for filmmakers is, you know, be organized.
Yeah, that's the first thing that I would say is you have to be organized because you could wing it, but you don't want to be the director who shows up on set and everyone's holding the equipment looking at you saying, okay, so what do you want to do?
You know? Well, that would be a fun set to go on. Yeah. Oh man,
yeah, and it would be a mess. And on the producer side, there's other aspects of that as well. When you're looking at directors at festivals, like that's another story.
Speaking of directing, do you direct your own shorts?
Yes, so far I've directed my shorts. Yeah. I've directed someone else's story as well in Life of Smiley,
right?
And that was the co-op program that I was talking about.
Yeah.
And I was it was a great gift to have a producing partner who had all the gear, all the equipment, and ready to shoot with a story of his own. And he said, "What do you think of this?" So I looked at that story and I thought, "Well, this could work." And so we started thinking about casting. And he said, "Okay, I'll take care of the production side." And I said, "But really, it's a big production." He goes, "Yeah, I'll take care of the production side. You take care of the actors." I said, "Okay, we're going to use the union." So I went to the union and I approached them for the co-op. And the co-op is we're all percentage owners. No one's getting paid.
Yeah.
So when I was talking to a journalist about it, I made a little quip saying, "Well, it's the only way I could afford to pay myself." So, I mean, it's the only way I could afford to hire myself is through the co-op program. So, because I was a union actor. So the funny thing was that we couldn't find the main character, Smiley, because I was looking online on the database, and we couldn't find it in time, and I was worried about not having enough time for this person. And so my producing partner said, "Well, why don't you do it?" And I said, no, I can't produce, direct, and act. It's going to be like overwhelming. And he said, no, you can do it. I got the technical side. Yeah. So he took over the technical side. He hired some extra crew through Mandy.com.
Yeah.
You know, Mandy.com. Yep. And we had a group of 8 crew and 8 actors, and I played the role of Smiley. And it ended up, production value looked great. The neat little tricks that happen when you're really going low budget, but looked great. Production value was amazing, and everything else worked out well. It's just that I liked the idea of the aerial shot that we were using because my producing partner said he had a client that had terrain that he wanted a helicopter to film.
Oh, boy.
Back in those days.
Yeah.
Used helicopters. You couldn't
use a drone.
So he had hired him to go on a helicopter and film his land near water and because he wanted to sell it.
Yeah.
And so he had the helicopter for like 10 hours or something, $1,000 an hour, $2,000. It was ridiculous. So while he had the helicopter, we had our production assistant drive the getaway car along the coast of the water.
Oh,
and the helicopter follows the car, does a round with the car, does a round without the car. So
you
we
got
free aerial footage.
In a time when you couldn't use a drone.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
The most expensive thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, oh, by the way, that's a secret. So I can't tell you anymore about the film. So we ended up doing that kind of thing. And so it worked well. It was favorable for the production value of it. And that's what he was able to bring to the table. And I was able to bring the actors to the table. And so we were able to get that production off the ground and get everybody to have 5% ownership or whatever it was. And we moved forward. And I brought up that story because you asked me about
directing.
And that was directing and acting
at the same time,
producing. So it was really getting a sense of communicating with the actors and getting what we want to get through and across, and then me being in front of the camera. And it all came out well because, again, I was blessed to have someone who knows what he's doing behind the camera.
Right.
And really, he could have directed. It could have, you know, it could have been him or me. And he knew what we were looking for. And he was the editor again.
Wow.
So it all worked out well that way. A driver's test, I did the same thing, producing, directing, and acting, because it was a shorter film and it was for my father. I wanted to do that. And I brought in an Armenian well-known actor to play my dad, so my father would have a kick out of it. And it worked out well to do that. And it did get distribution. It did get into festivals.
Wow.
And here's the thing I learned about festivals. One, if I could give advice about that, would be, I mean, I don't want to be pontificating, but
give advice. That's what we're here for.
Okay, well, for the festival run, I was going into to Boston and to Florida for their short film festivals in Delray Beach, Florida, and in Boston International Film Festival. And for these festivals, I decided I wanted to know what I was doing. I had asked around about advice, and I got advice from a producer about what to look out for and to go in, speak to a publicist.
Yeah.
Just tell them what you're up to and see if they would possibly help you or give you some guidance or some tips. And so I did.
Yeah.
And I got a name of someone to contact, and I also got her blessing for the film, because I said it's a driver's test about a senior. And she said, well, your timing couldn't be better.
That's fantastic.
An old lady drove into the test center of a drive test center into the wall. So there's controversy about seniors driving.
So
I was coming into a film festival with a film about an empathetic slant towards seniors and their driving. And and when I got there, I looked around and I saw directors for other movies sitting around with their crew, enjoying their time in Florida and not hustling their film.
We all
have poster cards. Back in the day, we were a pile of poster cards we're giving out to people to say, hey, come see my movie.
Yeah.
So I walked up and down the street, and wherever I saw seniors, I was handing out poster cards saying, I've just made a film. I'm from Canada. I just came in here. It's about seniors and driver's tests. And they were going, oh, really? I have a cousin who – I have a brother who just failed his. So next thing you know, my film had an audience. My film had bums in seats.
Yeah.
Even if they were old and slow, they were there.
Didn't matter. They're there to see the film, and you made that happen. That's marketing, my friend.
I was sitting around waiting for people to show up. I went out and gave it out. So my thing would be hustle it.
Yeah.
Get organized and sell it. Get out there and promote it.
That's fantastic.
But when you're a director, it's to not get too cocky with it. Not to just be careful of your attitude, really. You can't go into a festival expecting everyone to accommodate your ego. So being humble is really important. And my approach was, as soon as I went to the festival, I made sure the festival founder knew I was there.
Really?
And that I appreciated him inviting me.
Yeah.
And my film. And did he have any advice of what I could do to help promote my film? And within a day or two, he'd see me around. He'd walk over to me and he would give me a name of a person at a television station to give her a call. She's looking to interview some filmmakers.
Right.
And while you're in town, you'd be a good person to interview. So this was really wonderful that he was doing that.
Wow.
And it's all because I approached him and asked him that way. Instead of running around having a drink with somebody else who's making a film and just blah, 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 wasting precious promotion time, I tried to make sure that I would talk with the people and ask them to help me with my objective, like just because I'm there to promote my film. That's why it's in a festival. Yeah. So I would say about festivals is to make sure that you're organized, that you are putting all the efforts to promote and grow the popularity of your film.
I like what you said about being sort of hands-on, being there face-to-face mm-hmm. with people.
Yeah.
That's an important thing. I think that networking is a really important part of filmmaking.
Yeah. It's not everyone's cup of tea, though.
Not mine.
It feels, you know, it feels like schmoozing. It feels yeah. could be like artificial, but it doesn't have to be if you're authentic and if you're genuine and you're really okay. asking for help because, you know, you're at this point and you want to start this new approach to filmmaking and so on, and it's a yeah. whole new ballgame for you. And I think that that's a nice way to go about it. And it is the documentary or is this the feature? The fiction?
This is fiction. Yeah, this is a okay. narrative.
Okay. So, I mean, you're on the right track. You're going into a festival, which is wonderful. It's been accepted. It sounds great. And then my thing was always about being organized, and it's also about promoting it. You're aiming to sell it. And if they have any ideas of distributors that they know that are there.
Right.
You know, who might be there that you right. should, would they be able to point you in the direction of who to speak to about your film, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So you did, you've had some distribution in the past, haven't you?
Right. I did. And it's funny because, I'm going to tell you this quick story about my past, because when I had a lead role in a movie in 89, I had a starring role in a movie in Montreal. Then we had a recession in 1990, 91. And I ended up working in the corporate world selling franchises
Ooh.
Of travel agencies Ugh. Because I couldn't get an acting job.
Wow.
So I moved to Ontario and we were doing that. And during that time, I could say I don't have any regrets because it was a great learning experience about business.
Right.
And I studied electives in marketing and so on when I was at McGill, apart from the film program. But I really enjoyed the idea that I learned how to be a soft sell businessman selling, you know, in the corporate world. And it enriched my ability to do and function as a producer. I believe it helped having yeah. some business insight. So, and when it came to festivals and it came to getting distribution, when I went to that meeting with a distributor, in my mind, I was already closing the sale.
Right.
I was going in thinking, I got this.
Yeah.
And with a handshake, we're going to make the deal.
Right.
So I had the distributor at the time. We sat together and I showed them my film. And he giggled and laughed. And I said, okay, so I shake your hand now. We have a deal.
Yeah.
And that's my line. And it worked when I got my agent in Montreal. I walked into her office. I said, so if I shake your hand now, we have a deal. And then it was the same thing with the distributor. We had a deal. And so they took driver's test and they distributed wherever they distributed it.
Yeah.
And they had it was a 4-year contract and so on. So that's the kind of thing I think that distributors are looking for product and you're the product. You have
right.
the product.
Right.
So, you know, it's tough because it can seem like they're taking advantage and
right.
they have a bad rap because of how much percentage they want to own and so
right,
on. There is
right.
a little bit of that, but yeah, if you're not going to distribute it yourself, then yes, go for getting a distributor.
Wow.
And Watt Media is still around and they are grabbing short films. There's a lot of other people who are independents who are actually becoming distributors as well.
Yeah.
And, so it might be interesting to look at some of those who might be more aggressive as
yeah.
a distributor, but get your film out.
You know, I wonder if you can talk about, because we all have sort of horror stories from our filmmaking, right? We have
yeah.
problems that we've come up against. Can you talk about any kind of roadblocks that you've had to any of your films?
The current one was date and time, trying to shoot something
right.
in July when everyone was so busy. And I thought, oh, no, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
And then it was one of those things. Do I buy insurance now or make sure everything's
oh, yeah,
okay before?
Yeah.
So we did that. Putting all the odds in my favor is an expression I always use. Putting all the odds in your favor. For this production, being organized really helped because I was hit with one of the biggest, toughest colds I've ever had.
Shoot.
It didn't seem to go away. I lost my voice during the shoot on
wow.
the weekend.
Oh.
And it was so it was good in a way because I couldn't speak. So I would only use an economy of words to say it's working or it's not, or, you know, and it was perfect because I did want to give the actors and everybody the creative liberty to do what they bring to the table, and they're professional actors. So when you see them at work, it's so beautiful, and you'll never regret. You won't regret it, because, like, I look at the actors and how they added their own little texture to to the roles, the little decisions that they made for the character, which made me feel like it's great. I don't need to tell them what to do. I'm just making sure that everything's in the right parameters for where we want to go with the film.
Right.
And so the challenges I've had were things like date and time. In the past, I did have one big one. It was the eve before we were going to shoot the driver's test movie outside on the parking lot, which I rented of a rec center.
Yeah.
I had a secondary cinematographer. He was supposed to be the second unit cinematographer, cameraman.
Yeah.
He came with me on the evening to look at the location. And I said, well, what do you think? We'll put up a fake sign over there, and then we'll have the whole area, cars driving around. I rented three cars so that they'll just drive around, brand new cars, and everybody would be pretending to drive me around. And he was there, and I got the phone call from the entire crew of four people that were supposed to come and be the main camera operator and the sound guy and these guys, a group of four. They were referred to me by an organization that does a lot of that has a lot of members that are film people, and they were young. They had just graduated or they just come back from New York from a film school or something. So I thought, oh, okay, that sounds nice. I'll give them a shot, and we got this shoot that we're doing, and it'll be exciting for them to have some experience and for me to get this shot done really quickly. And they called me the night before, and they said, "We're not coming. We have a paintball game set in another town that day, so we can't be there. Oh. And plus, we didn't appreciate that you called the rental facility to make sure that the gear was rented." And I said, wait a minute, what? I hope that's not the reason, because, well, I'm producing this thing, and I just want to make sure that the gear was going to be there and allotted for us, that the one that you're supposed to pick up. What are you doing? You can't do this. And he goes, well, yeah, we're not going to be there. Sorry. Four people.
Wow.
Yeah, the night before the shoot.
What'd you
do? So I turned to the guy who was supposed to be secondary, who has a lot of experience, who's doing me a favor doing a secondary. Anyway, I turned to him and I said, look, Glenn, you mind taking over and being the main cinematographer? And he said, yeah, sure. And I said, yeah, but you remember when I said you can come in the afternoon? You think you could be here at 6:30 in the morning? Oh. So he was like, yeah, okay. I said, really? Great. And then the guy that was lending me his camera, another guy lending me his camera, agreed to be the other cameraman. Mm. So I said, okay, well, I need another camera now because that guy had the equipment and everything.
Absolutely.
So we had that guy drive in his car, the guy's lending his camera, drive to Vistec, pick up another camera, the Sony, and came back. And we had the gear, and we had other people jump in as production assistants, carry a boom, and do the whole thing. And another challenge during that shoot was I wanted to have a full screen monitor. I even brought my own.
Really?
So I could see what it would look like with the cameras recording on the screen.
Right.
Between the cinematographer and the camera person and the people there, the technical crew decided that we don't need that extra monitor. We have it on the camera.
Right.
So I was acting in this film. Right. I was sitting in the driver's seat with the guy playing my dad, and the two of us are looking over our lines. While they're setting up the camera, we're rehearsing our lines. We've got our text in front of us. We're looking at our lines.
Yeah.
So when you have your text, your white piece of paper in front of you, it's bouncing the sunlight up on your face.
Yeah.
You're lit up. Everything looks great on camera.
Yep.
When it was time for a take, we put the papers away and we did the take. So we went into the dark, and the camera monitor doesn't show that because the camera monitor is LCD. It looks great still.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we came into editing, I was told, I was lucky that we took the higher end camera, which had more information at the time on screen, so that we could play with the color correction and lighting and so on after the in post.
Wow.
So there were little bits of nightmares that took up a lot of time and energy and effort. But luckily, things fell into place because, and it turned out to be a better thing than having to deal with people who weren't professional in caliber at the time.
Wow. Well, I'm going to let people in on a little secret. I had a little bit of an issue with the with my recording device, and while I was doing that, you said something really interesting to me about gear, about cameras, and you know, I'm looking to buy my next camera, and you apparently
don't want to do that. I mean, I don't buy at all. I just rent.
You rent all your gear, right?
Yeah. Well, it's either the person has the gear, comes with the deal, or I'll rent a camera here and there, what we need. When you do the math, it depends on yourself. If you're going to be so busy, maybe it's worth your while to get a camera. Right. But you know how fast cameras are changing, just like computers and everything, right?
Crazy.
So to keep up with the technology, I would say rent if it's cost effective, because I don't know how much a new camera would cost. It depends what you want to get.
But exactly.
If it's going to cost you a few hundred dollars to rent it for a day or a little bit more for the entire weekend, you might want to do that instead of spending thousands on a camera.
Right.
And then realize you're only going to shoot something 6 months later or a year later.
Right.
And then you're still sitting with this camera that you're willing to rent out or, you know, but then you rent it out to someone and they go, oh, sorry about the scratch. Is it your insurance, their insurance?
Exactly.
What kind of headache is that going to be? So I don't know. I think it's working for me this way because I didn't actually go into being a shooter.
Right.
I went in, you know, I got the vision for the thing. I know how I want it to play out. I know where the camera should be and how the angle should be. I'm not going to grab the camera and shoot it. And if I did, then I think I'd still rent and get familiar with the camera at the time.
Right.
You know,
okay.
And I'm hearing there are still some cameras from the past that are still really good.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll give you that cinematic quality.
Mm-hmm. The Red One is one of those cameras. And I think that's what Danny McIver is using. He's using the Red One.
Yes, use the Red.
It's beautiful.
Was the theme of the whole movie. The thongs were red. Everything was love. And so red camera just made sense.
So there you go. It just made sense.
Yeah.
Listen, so now I am down to what I call my big three questions at the end of...
That sounds like you're going to scare me with these.
No, not at all. In fact, you may have touched on one of these already. But so what is the biggest filming mistake you ever made and how did you overcome it?
Oh boy, just one?
Well, I said the biggest.
Biggest filming mistake I ever made is, I think the biggest filming mistake that I would make is not believing in myself.
Oh, that is a big thing for a lot of filmmakers. It really is.
Yeah, and it really it has to do with confidence. It has to do with something about self-doubt or those effects, because those insecurity type things surface and they do get in the way of moving a project forward. For example, taking 12 years to do another film.
Yeah.
You know, and if I didn't pull this one off, I just thought about the consequence that I would go through another winter with regret of, you know, I didn't feel like I did. Last year, I resorted to writing a book. I actually wrote a book because, it was actually a dare between a friend of mine who with whom we've spoken about film. But we thought, hey, you know what? We should do something. And we said, okay, what do? Let's write a book. Everyone's writing a book. But no, let's make this book different. Let's make this book about quotes.
Right.
About life, every aspect of life. And it'll be a quote. So you're writing something or you're, a speech or something. You could refer to it and have a quote on any aspect of life. So we wrote a book about quotes life in quotes.
What's the title?
Life in quotes. I just forgot the title. I think it's called Life in Quotes. Simple as that. And it was it's on my website. And we did that. So it was a sense of accomplishment. At least I did something because I wanted to make a movie at the time. And the movie I was thinking about at the time was called Noseworthy, which is now still shelved. It's about an actor who has a funny nose and he thinks a nose job would change his life for the better. He doesn't get a nose job, but he goes to a clinic thinking he's going to get a nose job.
Right.
But there's a bumbling, disorderly orderly who causes an accident and knocks the actor unconscious, and he bumps the actor's nose, and so his nose starts to bleed. So the orderly doesn't want to get in trouble, so he shoves gauze up the actor's nose and puts him in a recovery room. The actor wakes up thinking he got a nose job and walks out of there happy and smiling and friendly to everybody. Yeah. He changes his attitude and changes his life.
Exactly. Wow.
So it's all. I love psychological humor.
You know, it's all about how you see yourself and how you carry yourself and believing in yourself.
Right. So the biggest thing that gets in the way, or the biggest mistake I ever made, was not believing in myself.
Wow.
I think that's what it is. Having a hard time believing in myself.
Yeah.
And taking time to get stuff done, or taking time that I need to. And actually, I was busy. Busy writing and doing other things as well, and acting.
But so. you overcame it. You definitely overcame it. So what is the best filmmaking advice you ever received?
Best filmmaking advice I ever received. I've received a lot of advice. Filmmaking wise, some of them are okay. Well, apart from believe in yourself, like my wife would give me that filmmaking advice. I think it was an influence to be organized. It wasn't actually advice given to me, but one of the advice I can tell you, directing wise. It's counterintuitive. It's counter what you learn in school, where you should take a long shot, establishing shot, and medium and close up. You know, I think as an actor, when I arrive on set and I'm fresh and ready and looking over my lines, I'm determined. Everyone's determined at the beginning to really get that energy going, and we want to do that scene. And then it's like, okay, we're going to take a long shot, establishing shot. So you're walking through the process of doing that scene. Then we're going to take a medium shot. Then we'll take a close up after lunch. We're going to break for lunch now. So suddenly you're doing a close-up, and your eyes are red. You've been up since 5, and it's afternoon, and you're tired and puffy and sleepy, and now is when they want to do the close-up.
Wow.
You have hair and makeup, but you got eyes are red and everything. Like, I think, why not shoot the close-up when the actors are fresh and ready?
I never thought about that.
Not many people do. Because we're trained to do the establishing shot because you don't want to forget. You want to have that as a backup. You want to resort to that. You want to make sure you secure that in the shot.
Yeah.
So you do that, and it depends on the circumstance. If it's going to be a long day or you're going to lose lighting, you probably need that establishing shot at the right time for the lighting. But if you can, get those close-ups done earlier.
That's a great piece of advice. I'm going to take that advice. That's a good piece of advice.
And make it your own.
I'll start sharing it with other people, saying it's mine.
Michael Sinelnikov, that actor I told you about, was a CBC producer and director, and he gave me a lot of this type of advice.
Wow, that's
brilliant.
He
mentioned things like that, and you think, wow, I didn't realize.
Well, since we're talking about advice, do you have sort of a list of advice that you can give?
They're basically lessons from me. Where I would say, like, for example, hire more PAs if you have to, like, because from in this particular and the other film, we had more in the other one, but this one in particular, I could have used one or two more because the amount of gear I saw Danny McIver bring, I thought, no, you need more help.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's good to have production assistants to be able to help with all kinds of facets, and it's really rewarding for production assistants when they're able to engage in other facets than just being a schlepper, running things, errands. I was a production assistant, and I learned a lot about filmmaking. I was, gifted. I mean, given the opportunity to work with the art department, and it was in the movie called The Carpenter. A long time ago, and it's funny because I was hired as a background or something to that effect, a small role, and I saw the crew having so much fun. I said, you know what, I have a car. Do you need extra help? Do you need any help with anything? I don't mind. And I was looking for a summer job anyway, and he said, yeah, sure, you have a car, how about you drive the actors around? I said, okay. So you start Monday, $300 a week or whatever it was, and I was driving the actors around. It was great. And then the art department had me take this torso of a man whose body is supposed to burn up. Myself and another person from the art department, we took this. It was garbage now. We were done with it. But it looked like a real human torso. Art department had made it plastic and whatever with the colors and everything and a charred looking body. And we did something really creepy. I shouldn't be telling you this.
Oh, tell it. Go on. Tell us all.
We threw it in a nearby forest.
Oh. Oh my God! Were there any phone calls to the police?
We were out of that town, and we don't know if anybody walking their dog saw that.
That is a vicious practical joke, my friend.
I know, it's terrible. It's terrible. I can't believe I just revealed something very bad about myself. Anyway, so lesson is hire more PAs. Use backgrounds whenever possible because it makes the scene more realistic.
Right.
Believe in yourself because you got to do it. You have a vision. You have the creativity. Use your imagination to get yourself off the ground and believe in yourself. Get all the footage you can. And you know, you write it down. You want to go out there. You want to get all the footage so that you don't come back thinking we should have, would have, could have done another shot. That kind of thing. Organize so that you don't overlook everything.
Right.
And treat everyone well.
Oh.
I don't like eating pizza on set. I love pizza. There's nothing wrong with pizza. I love gourmet pizza. I love my preference is to have sheep feta with basil and, you know, black olive, whatever, like a Greek pizza. I would love pizza. But when it comes to film, I'm so tired of people saying, hey, come, we'll make a movie. We'll eat pizza and we'll have fun.
Yeah.
No. I know friends who are bodybuilders. I know friends who have certain specific diets. They can't have pizza on set. So go, if you can do catering.
Right.
If you know someone who will cook something or chop up a tabbouleh, have some salad, have some rice and meat for somebody and, you know, have a variety so the vegans can enjoy it, the carnivores can enjoy it.
Yeah.
Make sure that everyone's happy and it's not just the promise of pizza. Any other lessons? Lots. I don't know if it's from mistakes or from, my point about imagination is really to push yourself to be the best savvy version of yourself in whatever category that you're in. If you're a producer, director, actor, you want to push yourself to be the best in that area. So we're talking about filmmaking. So as a producer, you want to put the odds in your favor. So have the binder that's organized.
Yeah.
Be professional, be respectful for people's time, and make sure that you're going to invite journalists, the catering, the taking care of people's parking, things like that, to accommodate so that no one says, hey, they weren't nice, they didn't do this, or they didn't do that. You want to make an environment that everyone wants to come back to.
Yeah.
That is, it's about the experience. Like I was saying, it's about the experience of filmmaking and everyone wants to be a part of it.
Yeah.
In this Love Thongs, I at one point even considered doing it as a co-op, changed my mind, but the actors carried on in it as though it was a co-op, as though they had a vested interest.
Wow.
And I saw between camera setups and what we were doing that the makeup artist and makeup and hair artist was working with the actress and rechanging her hairstyle because it was another day.
Yeah.
And they put in that effort that I didn't have to come up to them and say, hey, remember, it's another day.
Right.
They took care of their costume to make sure it was a different day.
Right.
They were engaged so much. And it comes with the territory. They are professional actors. They are union actors.
Right.
I'm not saying don't go non-union. I'm just saying when you have union, your odds are good that you're going to get something worthwhile.
Right.
And I don't know what it is in terms of price difference between a non-union actor and a union actor, but for the tip program, they make it really cost effective.
Yeah.
So you may want to consider that. But if you're – the non-union world has grown exponentially in the last 12 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that the networking party that Danny McIver is involved with, that support group, I couldn't believe the number of non-union production people and actors and what an industry.
Yeah.
But I'm on the union side.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'll never do a non-union directorial thing, but if I did, I kind of feel as though I'd want to coach the actors.
Right.
Just to make sure that that they might be able to gain some insight from someone who's been in the union to know little performance things when they don't realize they might be playing it big or small or whatever.
Right.
You know, so that kind of thing. I didn't want to go too far in the union thing.
Right.
Treat everyone well, promote it, sell it, have that binder, get organized, accommodate as best as you can. And anything else that I mentioned that you might have, well, believe in yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really the big one.
Okay, well, you know what? Now I'm going to give you something that is just, it's about films. And it's, can you name a film that you think is underrated?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Underrated. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I know, I know the one that I would say, but.
What would you say? I don't.
I would say In Bruges.
Which one?
In Bruges.
In Bruges?
Yeah, it's a fantastic film. And I just don't think enough people have seen it. Enough people are talking about it. It's a great film. So that's for me.
I don't have one particular film, but sure. I'll tell you something in general. I think I'd like to see the day when people get out to see more Canadian films.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Canadian films are underrated. A lot of them are.
I think indie films are underrated.
Yes, yes. And so I don't want to see Canadian films only make it to the theater for 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I also feel sorry for the indie producers and directors who are having to showcase their films by paying to buy out the theater so that they can screen their movie to get it screened in Canada.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really, you know, it sounds sad, but to name one film that's underrated, oh, my God, there's so many. I mean, we could write a book about that. We could. I think that's a good idea.
Oh.
50 underrated movies.
Uh-oh.
Should that be a book idea?
Uh-oh, that could be. Well, you know what?
That's a few coffees, but I'm sure we can come up with them. right now, I can't really come up with an underrated movie. I'm trying to think of one. I should have done, you know, I should have thought about it earlier, but underrated movies. Most of the ones that I'm in. But wait, I have been on a few blockbusters, and I have worked on lots of television series as well, like Flashpoint and Murdoch Mysteries and Mayday and Canadian produced productions.
Look for Carlo Asagian movies, everybody.
Yeah,
that's what you got to do.
My website is carloasagian.com.
Yep, yeah. And that's what I'll put that in the show notes. And that's what I was going to ask you is that where can people find out about what you're up to? And
okay,
and that's your site, right?
Currently, the movie is called Love Thongs.
Yeah.
And I plan to take it out to festivals as soon as we've got it ready to go. And based on the availabilities of festival dates and so on, I'll plan to target that. And I will have a site for it. Right now, the site title is lovethongs.net. But that right now redirects to my own site currently until there's a proper site developed for it.
Absolutely.
Once I've got footage or a short of the short, a trailer. But this was a lot of fun, and I'm wondering, did I cover a lot of what we wanted to?
Oh, absolutely.
Share?
You have covered a great deal. In fact, you've given a lot of people a ton of information, Carlos.
The tips.
They're fantastic.
Really,
absolutely. So that's great, man. Thank you very much.
Okay. Did you want me to summarize those tips, or we got it?
No, we got it, man. This is great. So they can find you at carloasagian.com.
Right.
I'll put that in the show notes. And Carlo,
okay.
thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Have a great one. And I love what you're doing, so keep doing it. So this is great and very informative. I've listened to a couple of years already, these podcasts.
Well, thanks.
And I was impressed. I
really appreciate that. So thanks a lot, man.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Well, that's our show for today, and I really want to thank you all for listening. I also want to thank Carlo for dropping by and sharing so much great information with us. He had some fantastic ideas that I know I'm going to be using on my next project. As always, if you have any comments or questions about the show, please drop me a line by email at howtheydiditpodcast@gmail.com or stop by my Facebook page at howtheydiditpodcast. Please show your support for the show by subscribing on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Remember to share and rate the show as well. Thanks again for joining me, and I'll be back next week with another show. Until then, keep shooting.